I'm going to start by introducing the notion of experimental life writing, which, as far as I've been able to establish, was used for the first time in 1980 by Donald J. Winslow in a glossary of terms in life writing. It's a very brief entry, and so I wouldn't even... That's curious. Okay, I wouldn't say that Winslow introduced this notion to critical discourse, but it's just a brief occurrence, and the definition is pretty basic, breaking new ground, especially in method, by biographers and autobiographers, and Winslow notes that the first half of the 20th century was particularly productive. When it comes to those unconventional forms of life writing, this is not going to be exactly the period that I'm going to concern myself with during today's lecture. So let me just mention briefly three of the works that Winslow mentions. Those works are also referenced by other authors whenever this notion of experiments in biography or autobiography is talked about. So Lytton Strachey's Eminent Victorians, sometimes called the inaugural work of modern biography, an irreverent portrayal of four Victorian icons, including Florence Nightingale, among them. Virginia Woolf's Orlando, which I believe some of you might be familiar with, a work which we don't read as a biography really, or as a work of life writing, but it was received as a mockery of some of the received conventions of biographical writing. And Gertrude Stein's The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas. There is something odd about what I've just said, that the autobiography of somebody could be written by somebody else. On the last page of this book, the narrator reveals that the I is not really the I of the protagonist, but the eye of the author, Gertrude Stein. In order to be able to perhaps grasp what experimental life writing rebels against or maybe reacts to, it would be useful, at least very, very briefly, to explain what this much broader notion of life writing usually means. What we understand by it. So a very brief definition from Cuddon's Dictionary of Literary Terms. All kinds of accounts of individual lives and life experience. You can see that this notion is very, very broad. It includes biography, autobiography, diaries, memoirs, and the list could go on for much longer. Sharon O'Brien, in an article in which she discusses the conventional Victorian biography of the 19th century, she lists a number of certitudes, like convictions that you can find in conventional biographies. I'd say that, you know, this could be representative of some of those convictions that could be found in all of quote-unquote conventional life writing. That language is a transparent medium capable of representing the world, that character and the self are knowable, that the cause and effect, those convictions and the character, among the characteristic features of this kind of writing is the linear narrative, chronological plot arrangement, and a trustworthy narrator. And in one of the most popular primers on autobiography, Sydney Smith and Julia Watson make this a point that in life writing, it seems inevitable to arrange the chaos of individual experience into some kind of a story. So the implication is that most life writing takes narrative form. And experimental life writing very often maybe defines against this narrative formula for human lives. It seems to suggest that storying a life may be perhaps an intervention that somewhat that perhaps imposes a pattern where there is no pattern, that it's illusory. It gives us an illusory sense that every life makes sense, that it has a meaning, that it has a purpose, in the way that a narrative of a popular novel does have like a moral point. It does aim for a neat conclusion. And that story of one's life becomes the basis of one's identity, especially in autobiographies, in like those conventional autobiographies. The story is like a justification of a life, of a meaningful life, of a life well lived. Okay, we're going back to experimental life writing. I would argue that the notion was actually introduced to kind of literary studies, to critical discourse, by Irene Kakandas, who wrote a chapter in the Routledge Companion to Experimental Literature, which came out in 2012. The chapter was called Experimental Life Writing. It's an attempt to try and sort of provide a little bit of historical background for this notion, and also an attempt to define it and to offer a kind of a tentative, rather simple classification. And Kakandas proposes that experimental life writing employs a technique for the purposes of fact or of enhancing, reinforcing, or drawing attention to the referential level, and it aims to convey some aspect of the realness of certain life experiences that could not be conveyed as well without pushing at the form itself. She stresses here the connection between experimentation and realism, which may not be obvious to us. She argues that some authors believe that it is not possible to convey a certain experience without breaking from the recognized forms of expression. And so they push at this form, they propose some new formal solutions. And but she stresses in her discussion that this experimentation needs to be confined to the form, not to the content. What she means by this is that the authors of life writing must stick to the truth, the biographical or the autobiographical truth. They can't take any liberties with the actual content, but they can arrange this content, present this content in any form that they find effective. In other words, she argues that authors of experimental writing must not break the autobiographical pact, which is a notion introduced by Philippe Lejeune, which argues that in a work of autobiography, the author, the narrator, and the protagonist must be identical. Okay, and now I would like us to move on to the classification that Kakandas proposes. Four categories. The first one involves experiments with time. So all those works that deviate from this trite formula of an elderly author, person, reminiscing about their life. And so, for instance, among the examples that she provides is Christa Wolff's One Day a Year, 1960-200, which swaps this kind of end-of-life perspective for like an ongoing perspective of every consecutive year. What this German author embarked on doing was to write a couple of pages every year on the 27th of September. And so from 1960 to 2000, she wrote a couple of pages in which she gave some kind of an account of her mindset, of where she was at in her life on that day. And in 2003, this book came out as a single volume of 600 pages. Wolf seems to have become so addicted to that routine that she went on writing such accounts for the next 11 years of her life. And when she died, 11 years later, and then there is a second volume of the extra 11 years of those accounts of those days in her life. Alexander Masters's Stuart, A Life Backwards is an experimental work of biography in more than one sense. Kakandas discusses it in this category because it attempts to tell a life in the reverse chronological order. But what is also unusual about this book is that it's a biography of a person who's entirely unknown. The author came across this man named Stuart in one of the streets of Cambridge. The man was an ex-homeless person with a long criminal record. And he became fascinated by his story, and he decided to write a biography of somebody that no one has even heard about. By the way, apparently, when the author presented this Stuart with what he wrote with his first attempt, Stuart said, "It's bollocks boring." And he urged him to find an alternative way of writing it, and he actually, it was his idea to write it backwards. And apparently, yeah, it seems to work much better that way. The second category, experiments with the medium. In this category, Kakandas discusses a number of acclaimed graphic memoirs. And so the very idea of writing one's life in the form of a comics here counts as an experiment with the medium, but the genre of graphic memoirs has, I would say, by now become so popular that perhaps it doesn't strike us any longer as an experiment in itself. But maybe 10 years ago when Kakandas wrote this chapter, it still seemed a bit of a novelty. So Maus, Art Spiegelman's Maus, and Alison Bechdel's Fun Home is also mentioned by Kakandas, Marjan Satrapi's Persepolis. And she also references a couple of works that are multimodally, well, no, that's not much of an adverb, I'm not sure, but works that have some rich multimodal layer, meaning that they feature some experiments with typography, with the layout of the work, which include images in a kind of non-standard way. And Dave Eggers's A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius is one of such examples. The third category, the relational, it may sound less obvious than the previous two categories. By this category, Kakandas means works that were born out of an, I quote her, unusual entanglement between the author and the subject. So this is a category reserved for biographies rather than autobiographies. For instance, she also includes in this category Stuart, A Life Backward, because of this kind of relationship that the author had with his hero, but also two Holocaust family memoirs, such as Maus, because like as many of you know, right, the one of the themes of Maus is also the relationship between the father, in other words, the hero, and Art, the author. Also, Patrick Modiano's Dora Brüder, which is a result of a very tenuous connection between the author and the subject. I'm not sure if anyone is familiar with that book. By tenuous, I mean that the author knows almost nothing about the subject of his biography. There is just this one ad in a newspaper from 1942 that says that a Jewish girl named Dora Brüder escaped from some institution, and this kind of piques, you know, we could say, the author's curiosity, and he tries to imagine a possible story for Dora Brüder. So it's a biography, but it's to a large extent a work of fiction because no facts are available, or very few. And one other work, but I'm going to kind of accelerate a little bit. The last category, the work's focus. And here, Kakanda says that in this category she includes works that are born out of an entanglement with the author's own self, which is a curious maybe phrase. So in these works, the subject is not so much the author's life, but rather the author's mind, or a focus, or the focus is placed on the very process of writing an autobiography. So there's a meta element to this category. And here she includes J.M. Coetzee's Summertime and Roland Barthes. Par Roland Barthes, I'm going to return to Barthes in a moment again. Moving on to the last, third and last critical account of, a critical attempt to shed some light on this notion. In 2017, Palgrave released this collection of academic articles titled Experiments in Life Writing. And it was edited by Julia Novak and Lucia Boldrini. And Julia Novak wrote a long introduction, which I would say constitutes the most comprehensive attempt to kind of theorize and historicize this notion. Mind you, she calls it experiments in life writing rather than experimental life writing, but well obviously we can kind of, I suppose, kind of merge those two notions. She defines them as works that, I quote, push at the boundaries of existing forms to mold them into something that better suits the writer's efforts of representation. Her definition seems to be very similar to that proposed by Irene Kakandas. She also stresses representation, realism. After all, we're dealing with life writing, so we're dealing with nonfiction. So evidently, the truth needs to be kind of still there, right? But liberties can be taken with form. And she provides a more extensive classification with seven categories, and only one overlapping category, the last one, media or medium in Kakandas. And once again, very briefly, I would like to show you some of the examples that she includes in those specific categories. The first one, quite a commonsensical category. So the experiments with the subject. So the default option for a biography or an autobiography is to devote it to a person, to a human being. But as Virginia Woolf demonstrated in Flush, it is also possible for a work of life writing to have a canine protagonist. In Peter Ackroyd's London, the biography, a city, it turns out, is also like a worthy kind of candidate of having its own biography. And she also lists, Novak also lists Alberto Manguel's Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, a biography. And Roland Barthes, par Roland Barthes, once again, because the subject is not so much Roland Barthes, really, in the sense of his life, but rather his intellect, his intellectual universe. What constitutes the bulk of that book is not an account of Barthes' life, but rather an account of some of the ideas that have been particularly important to his thinking. The great majority of the book takes the form of a glossary of alphabetically arranged ideas, concepts, notions such as adjective or active passive. The second category, genre, situations when the kind of genre of the biography or the autobiography is deliberately, well, contaminated is not a good word, but infused maybe with, she says, ostentatiously infused with another genre. In Ford Madox Ford's biography of Joseph Conrad, which was published several months after Conrad's death, the full title is Joseph Conrad, A Personal Remembrance. Madox Ford introduces a number of elements of literary theory. So it reads like a blend of biography and literary criticism, which is these days maybe not so unusual. And Peter Handke, the Nobel Prize winner of 2020, in his work Storm Still, combines autobiography with tragedy, with drama. Style. The style of the in which a given biography or autobiography is written is strongly reminiscent of a specific style that is not associated with non-fiction. In the case of B.S. Johnson's Trawl, it is the style that one would associate it with Samuel Beckett, for instance, or all the examples that she provides are examples of very kind of avant-garde kind of styles that seem to clash with the expected, somewhat neutral style of nonfiction. In Christine Brooke Rose's remake, there is, the style is described as Novak as the depersonalized use of the present tense. Experiments with structure in Jackie Kay's Red Dust Road, accounts of the present and of the past are constantly interspersed. In the broadest terms, in this category she includes various disturbances of the chronological account of a life, a linear chronological account. Laszlo Foldeny's Heinrich von Kleist, Im Netz der Wörter, a biography of the German writer Heinrich von Kleist, takes the form of an alphabetical glossary of various aspects of Kleist's life. Intertextuality and metalepsis, just to use the example of Red Dust Road, or maybe of Christine Brooke Rose, sorry. In this book, which came out as a work of nonfiction, and which is an account of Brooke Rose's own life, the author introduces as characters characters from her own works of fiction, thus somehow blurring the distinction between fiction and nonfiction. Play with names and pronouns, two works that we have already mentioned. So Gertrude Stein's consistent use of I throughout the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, only to reveal on the last page that this I is not actually who the reader thought it was. And Ford Madox Ford's biography of Joseph Conrad, in which occasionally he uses the pronoun we in order to talk about events that we know only happened to Conrad. So it seems that at some point, there are moments when this kind of communion between the author and the subject takes place, and it's no longer certain who is being talked about. Madox Ford also uses the term the writer several times when talking about Conrad's life, but it seems that he is also talking about himself. The last category, media. So as I said, an overlap with Kakandis's classification. She also includes Mouse and other graphic memoirs. And just one more instance, a work that hasn't been mentioned so far, Janice Galloway's biography of Clara Schumann, which incorporates some elements of musical notation, and it also includes certain typographic experiments. There are also a number of related concepts. There are many more of them than the ones I'm showing you right now. Terms that are used in order to denote a specific departure from convention, from a departure from one of the many conventions of biography or autobiography. David E. Nye introduced the notion of anti-biography in his work that he also titled An Anti-Biography of Thomas Edison. Autofiction, a category that some of you may have come across, a very productive critical category lately. Digital biography, which I have used in the title of this work, and a notion that I will return to in a moment. Metabiography, paramemoir, another notion introduced by Irene Kakandis. But I'm not going to define them all, and I would like us to move on to something else. Right now, as Professor Guignery mentioned, we are working on a post-conference volume devoted to experimental life writing, and we're working on an introduction in which we give an account of, you know, of what I've given you an account of right now, and we also propose several characteristic features of the poetics of experimental life writing. So looking at this body of this rather rich body of works that we believe this notion can be applied to, we distinguish between the following formal traits: the blurring of the distinction between nonfiction and fiction, something that Irene Kakandis warns authors not to do, but still many of the works that we've looked at kind of play with incorporating certain techniques of fiction into works that are ostensibly works of nonfiction. Anti-narrative disposition, this may sound a little bit like academic jargon, but what we mean by this is that these works kind of defy against this expectation that the only way or the most efficient way to tell a life is to arrange it into a story and thus to cut off all the elements that don't fit into that simplified, neat, linear story. Fragmentation, hybridity, so incorporating various genres, confronting various generic conventions, the elusiveness and indeterminacy of the autobiographical subject. I'm going to say another word about this in a moment. Yeah. Now, I'm also currently working on a different project, which is concerned with various unconventional forms of life writing that, instead of using a narrative structure, favor the structure of an archive or a database. So here I would like to very briefly introduce this concept of the archive, which over the last several decades has been quite an important critical notion. Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, Paul Ricoeur have written quite extensively on the archive. Derrida coined the notion archive fever. Hal Foster talks of the archival impulse, archival craze, archival turn. All of those notions are in circulation. There is a book that has recently come out from Yale University Press titled Archive Everything by Gabriella Giannacchi. And that author, in the introduction to this book, talks about, I quote, our obsession with the augmentation, documentation, and transmission of our own presence. One of the most easily noticeable manifestations of this obsession are various applications that enable us to store data that kind of records what we've eaten, where we've been, etc. So various activity trackers, like how many miles we've run, how many steps we've taken. These apps have, over the last couple of years, become extremely popular. Okay. Mm. And the notion of the database, which was, I would say, introduced as a critical concept by Lev Manovich in The Language of New Media in 2001. Manovich argues or presents the database as this new way to structure our experience of ourselves and of the world. Not only is it a new way, but he argues it is bound to become the dominant way, the dominant cultural form. He argues that whereas in the 19th century, this dominant cultural form was the novel, in the 20th century, cinema, and he believes that in the 21st century, the database will be this hegemonic cultural form. He is not alone in thinking this. Marlene Manoff has called the database the prototypical genre of the 21st century. And it's a concept that's very closely connected to the archive. It could actually be, it could be called the digital equivalent of an archive, or simply a digital archive. It's a way of representing the world as a list of items and refusing to order those items or to create a hierarchy between those items. It's a very kind of leveling perspective, maybe. And one last point that I would like to address, it's important to this argument that I began with, this resistance towards narrative. Lev Manovich argues that the database is, I quote, the natural enemy of the narrative, and he believes that at the beginning of the 21st century, we are observing this confrontation of narrative and database, and Manovich believes that database is going to emerge as the winner, from that confrontation. And in this own project, this sort of personal kind of project of mine, I'm working with some kind of tentative categories that I would like to present you with. It's going to turn into a little bit of an archive of some categories that in them have some work. So sorry to kind of flood you with multiple categories and examples. You may walk out of this classroom feeling a little bit dizzy. Okay, so the first category are archives that follow alphabetical arrangement, such as a glossary. I've already mentioned to you that this is the adopted form of Barthes' experimental autobiography. I'm not sure if you can see here. It says actif, reactif, l'objectif, les. Actif, adjectif, es. If you disregard the le, the alphabetical order is maintained. Jed Pearl's Antoine's Alphabet, Watteau and His World, is a biography of the painter Antoine Watteau, which takes the form of a of a series of mini essays devoted to specific aspects of Watteau's life and work, but each of those mini essays has a title, and those titles, those sections are arranged alphabetically. But those building blocks in this biography are somewhat longer than the ones that are used by Barthes. The encyclopedia is another alphabetical kind of genre of the archive. So Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life, 2005 by Amy Krauss Rosenthal. It's like a 300 page or so book that, it's kind of is what it says it is. It's an encyclopedia, so of various aspects of the author's life. The focus is placed on this quotidian existence rather than on any major events that took place in the author's life. And I would like to present you with just two randomly chosen, they weren't actually randomly chosen. I actually quite like those ones, but okay, anyway. So we can see, so even though it's it says it's an encyclopedia of an ordinary life, but there's a very clear presence of I. It is an autobiography, except, as I said a moment ago, it tends to focus on everyday life rather than on notions that are very kind of specific to a given subject. And the index, Joan Wickersham's The Suicide Index, which is an attempt to come to terms with the experience of losing one's father to suicide. It's an experience that Wickersham has described as extremely chaotic and disintegrating, and so she came up with the idea of trying to make some sense through it by adopting this very rigid, logical, alphabetical structure. And so it's a rather kind of paradoxical vehicle for processing such a personal tragedy, but in her case it works. The book was shortlisted for National Book Award in 2009. So, by the way, I'm not sure if you can see, so the entire book takes the form of a single huge index entry, suicide, but it's subdivided into like sub-entries, suicide, act of, and then a further subdivision, attempts to imagine, bare bones account, immediate aftermath. The bibliography, we're still looking at alphabetical archives. Rick Moody wrote a 20-page piece titled Primary Sources, which adopts the form of an MLA bibliography. And the idea is that he selects 50 works that were important, that were formative influences on his life. Most of them are books. Some of them are like works of popular culture, like Star Trek, some Marvel comics, an album by Syd Barrett, a pamphlet by Alcoholics Anonymous, a Frank Zappa recording. He provides 20 footnotes in which he explains the significance of some of the included works. And through those footnotes, we can reconstruct some image of Rick Moody as a person, but obviously the works that he found influential also give us some sense of who he is. Elisa Washuta's preliminary biography, which does something similar, except she gives a chronological account of various books that were important to her. It starts with comics and picture books, because it's a chronological account, and then it ends with some works of serious literary fiction. Two more bibliographies. Steve Fellner's Self-Portrait as a 1980s Cineplex Movie Theatre and Abecedarian, sorry, not sure if I know how to pronounce this. And so this one focuses on films. It is arranged alphabetically. It begins with Miloš Forman's Amadeus. And for each entry, there is a brief kind of autobiographical commentary on when he saw this film, under what, like in what circumstances. And then a very, perhaps the most unusual of the four, Spam Bibliography by Angela Janusa, which is what it promises to be, a bibliography of all the messages that ended up in the spam folder of this author. Not during her entire life, that would be difficult to arrange, but during a single year. So from the 1st of January one year to the 31st of December, the author would meticulously save all the spam messages, because obviously otherwise if you don't save them, they will disappear after 30 days. And then also very meticulously, and evidently with quite a lot of kind of patience and determination, she arranged them according to the tenets of, I think, MLA. And so what we get is an alphabetically arranged bibliography starting from the sender. Like free cams today. Even though Angela Janusa, I think, as far as I know, identifies herself as female, many of the emails that ended up in her spam folder and in the book are penis enlargement offers. Okay. And then moving on to chronological archives. The already mentioned One Day a Year by Christa Wolf, I've already kind of explained, right? So each chapter, each section is an account of one consecutive year. Alexandra Nemirov's First My Motorola, which is an interesting exercise in self-documentation. During one day, the author decided to keep track of every single item she touched, focusing on items that with which you can associate a specific brand. And so this is a chronological account of all the kind of branded objects that she touched on this one day. It starts with Motorola, and then you can see it's a much, much longer list. I'm only showing you, I don't know, the first 15 or so. It ends with a Motorola as well, from which we can conclude that she probably has a smartphone, or had at the time, by Motorola, and that she's using it as an alarm clock, because the last object she touches and the first one she touches in the morning are the same, or are from the same, whatever brand. Tan Lin's Bib Rev Ed is a result of a similar project of self-observation and self-documentation. The author, it's like a diary in which the author takes note of every single thing he read during a day and then the following day, and he continued to do this for a couple of years, and the book is relatively long. It's also unreadable, which is... But okay, well, when you can just kind of flip through it and see that, you know, he read an article by Slavoj Žižek for 3 minutes, and then he moved on to Wikipedia, and then he read an article by New York Times. And so obviously it's not a book that you are supposed to read from the beginning to the end. I don't think anyone has. I came close to it by kind of reading / scanning all of it. But you get an insight into how we read these days, how fragmentary our reading is, how we kind of jump back and forth between a text, a Wikipedia, our text messages, right? And it's interesting to kind of see a record of it. I may kind of skip a few things. This is a category I'm not exactly very happy with this label. I may kind of try to simplify this a little bit, but an anthology of posts or a social media archive, books which are records of their author's social media activity. Inbox by Noah Ellie Gordon is perhaps one of the least readable, the most unreadable works that I'm mentioning. It's just a record, like a copy and paste record of every single email that the author had in his inbox at a given point in time. Bio by Mariam Mona Lisa Garavi is a record of all her, was it Twitter or Instagram? Sorry, give me a second. Just a moment. It's not very important, maybe, but I don't want to give you any incorrect information. Twitter, yeah. So it's a record of all the changes that she made to her, character bio on Twitter, which apparently is something that Twitter doesn't provide any record of. So if you change your bio, then nobody will see your previous bio. And so this is an attempt to kind of preserve those bios. Okay. 25 Random Things About Me Too by Matthias Wegener is, again, an archive of 100 Facebook posts, each of which consists of 25 loose memories, 25 autobiographical snippets. And then the last category, other archives. I haven't found a neat kind of adjective for them. The Inventory, which is one of the books that's circulating, it's also an outcome of a self-documentation project by Claude Kloski. It's a record of all the objects that this artist had in his flat at the time of writing this book. So, mon canapé, mon poufli, and then there is a brief description that reads like a pastiche of advertising language. Georges Perec has also included a number of inventories, for example, of all the items that he ate and drank in the year 1975, or else all the places where he slept, or all the items on his desk, and these are collected in those two volumes. The catalog or the list, which includes probably my favorite piece of experimental life writing, which is Joe Brainard's "I Remember," just in circulation somewhere. It's a collection of 1,504. I wasn't the one who did the counting. Memories that are provided without any chronological order, without any thematic order. It reads like a very arbitrary list of things that the author remembers. And what is characteristic about this Brainard's method is that he is very strict about always opening each entry with the words "I remember," and then what follows obviously varies from entry to entry. And maybe you could take a look at a random page of this book. But it's circulating, so each of you can do this on your own. Okay, we can move on in that case. A few other works. I'm going to fast forward now. Leonard Michels does something similar as Brainard, but he focuses on a single decade, the 1950s. Wayne Kostenbaum does something similar, but with the 1980s, which is the decade of the AIDS crisis in New York City, which emerges as the theme of this work. And just to bring in the Nobel Prize winner, even though the whole of Les Années doesn't quite take the form of a catalogue or a list, it concludes with a brief one-page section where Ernaux includes 14 little autobiographical fragments, preceded by the words that she would like to save them. And here you can see some of those images from her past that she doesn't want to let go of. The portfolio, which, like, we know what a portfolio is, like a folder for keeping documents. I'm using this notion as a, like, an umbrella term for a couple of examples of experimental life writing that I have identified. They are very little known. For instance, let me just mention one example: Danatine Lomax's Disclosure, which is a little archive in print of 77 documents, parking violation notices, X-ray scans, bank statements, all of which are related to her life, but none of which were created by herself. And so this is a repository of various documents issued by state institutions that provide us some, each of them provides us some minimal insight into her life, but interestingly, in this category, the role of the author shifts from, well, the author to the person who just selects stuff that's already out there. And computation is about attempts to encompass a life in numbers. This is one of such experiments. This is another, Gregory Burnham's Subtotals, a one-page list of various, I think we could say random aspects of one's existence. I think there's a Berekian kind of tinge to, like, the number of refrigerators I've lived with. It goes on for a little while longer. Most of those elements seem somewhat trivial. And perhaps the most arbitrary and the most kind of avant-garde realization of this computation is Steve Guiasson's Autoportrait, a Quebecois artist who kind of wrote, well, there wasn't much to write in this, but kind of created, let's say, this book, which is just a record of various numbers which must have some relation to the artist's life. 23 centimeters by 16 centimeters, and then underneath 62 centimeters. The author doesn't provide any key to this. We don't know what those numbers refer to. The book begins with 183 centimeters, which is the only kind of unit of measurement that I believe one can make sense of. That's probably his height. But everything else seems just very, like, impossible to decode. Okay, I realize that we're kind of almost out of time, so very, very quickly, a transcript. Everything that the author said during 1 week has been typed up, probably by the author's assistant, and then what we get is like a river of language with no divisions of sections, very little punctuation, just, yeah. And talking on the phone, giving a lecture, there is no distinction here. Everything is just text. Everything reduced to text, with repetitions, with grammatical mistakes. That's Kenneth Goldsmith's soliloquy. A scrapbook, a family album, cutting out various elements like family photos, stamps from family correspondence, and then placing them in a book. That's what Anne Carson does in Knox, which is an attempt to commemorate her brother, who died a premature death. And then finally, this is my last category, the digital database, some examples of electronic literature, which also are driven by this archival urge. Shelley Jackson's My Body, a Wunderkammer, which is, well, as I said, an electronic work. So you click on a link, you see an image, a self-drawn image of the author with various body parts highlighted. And if you click on one of them, on one of those parts, rectangles, then you are led to a brief description of the significance of an anecdote, an incident in the life of Shirley Jackson that's in some way connected with that body part. And probably my favorite example, definitely my favorite example of electronic literature, David Clark's 88 Constellations for Wittgenstein, a digital biography of Wittgenstein, sadly, momentarily, presently, unavailable. This is often the case with works of electronic fiction, that they are around for a couple of years and then the software, the technology changes and you can no longer play them. But the author has promised me to do something about this. He says he's working on making it, on like relaunching it on the internet. It's a very kind of fragmentary, very experimental insight into Ludwig Wittgenstein's life. It takes the form of 88 animations, which are portrayed as constellations on the night sky. The reader can click on any of them. They can experience this work. I'm deliberately not using the word read because there is relatively little to read. It's mostly a matter of watching and listening. The reader can take any order they like, and this work is very rich in intertextual references. It's ostensibly about Wittgenstein, but it's also about many other things that seem to have only a very tenuous link to Wittgenstein, such as the events of 9/11, such as Alfred Hitchcock, such as Adolf Hitler, such as Jean-Luc Godard. And that's another example of David Clark's digital kind of life writing, The End, Death in Seven Colors, which is, again, an account of the deaths of seven famous people, including Judy Garland, Jim Morrison, Sigmund Freud, Walter Benjamin, etc., Princess Diana, in the form of found footage material. And this is the end of my enumeration. And can I just take 1 minute for conclusions? Thank you. Okay, so sort of obviously those examples are very kind of peculiar, from peculiar to bizarre on a continuum. And many of them don't seem to have much of a, don't seem to give us much of an insight into the author or the subject. They purport to be works of life writing, but if all we get are scans, then the question is, what can we actually find out from it? We're not getting a narrative, but what are we getting instead? So the accounts that we get are fragmentary, and the effect of the fragmentariness of the structure and the form of those works is also the fragmentariness of the portrayal that emerges. As two Austrian scholars have said, the classical rounded biographical portrait is replaced by new dynamic and interchangeable fragments. This remark is made about the emerging genre of digital biography, but I believe that it holds for many of the examples of the works that I've shown you. I may move on a little bit. Anne Carson, the author of Knox, which I mentioned to you a moment ago, has said, in response to a question about the fragmentariness of the form of her book, she gave this answer, which, I believe is kind of also revealing about not just her work, but about the works that we've been talking about. Most of us, to be honest, are just a collection of bits that don't make sense. The portrayal of the self emerging from those works seems to attach a lot of importance to consumer behavior. There are plenty of accounts of buying, selling, especially in some of the works that I have glossed over, but you need to take my word for it. So it seems that our contemporary identity is to a great extent determined, it seems, from those works by our consumer choices. And because of that, because the kind of the range of brands available is limited. Well, there are a lot of them, but still, it seems that our contemporary selves could be regarded as permutations of some of the same available consumer options. And so the emphasis in most of those works seem to be on the uniformity of the contemporary self rather than on their uniqueness and individuality. And the final element I wanted to point out is the importance of data to most of those accounts, and allow me not to elaborate on this because we clearly don't have the time for it. So thank you so much for all your heavenly patience with me, and for allowing me to go on without end, but well, some end has arrived. Thank you so much.